Support for this podcast comes from the Fletcher School of Global Affairs at Tufts University. To start your future as a global changemaker, you must have context across fields like international business, cybersecurity, energy policy, and more. Don't just study global affairs, shape them. Visit fletcher.tufts.edu.
From 90.9 WBUR, I'm Meghna Chakrabarty. This is Radio Boston. Coming up, the Massachusetts House debates the transgender public accommodations bill.
No one in our state should be discriminated against. But nor should we be eliminating privacy rights and protection for our children.
Also today, in praise of partisan rancor, celebrated historian Sean Wilentz on why deep partisanship has always been a key driver of American democracy.
The framers of the Constitution, they didn't like parties. They thought parties were divisive. They thought that parties aided individual ambitions. However, they designed a government where parties were almost inevitable.
Plus, iRobot founder Rodney Brooks gives us a wake-up call on the future of robots.
Artificial intelligence is really, really hard, and we hardly understand anything, despite what some people say in the press. It's really hard. We know almost nothing.
That's all next on Radio Boston. First, the news.
Thanks for listening to the Radio Boston podcast. If you'd like to support WBUR, go to radioboston.org and click the pledge button in the upper right-hand corner. Okay, back to the show.
This is Radio Boston. I'm Meghna Chakrabarty. The Massachusetts House of Representatives is debating the Transgender Public Accommodations Bill. That's the proposal that would prevent discrimination in restaurants, hospitals, locker rooms, and bathrooms based on a person's gender identity. Here's Judiciary Chairman, Representative Democrat John Fernandez of Milford in support of the bill.
You can't tell somebody it's okay to work at the diner, but not okay to sit at the lunch counter.
Republican Jim Lyons of Andover, a vocal opponent of the bill, said the law would be eliminating privacy rights.
The law is so vague and so ambiguous, it just opens the door to allow people to do basically in these facilities whatever they want.
Now, the House debate comes just a day after Governor Charlie Baker said he would sign the House version in its current form if it reaches his desk. Well, joining us now from the State House is WBUR Steve Brown. He's been covering today's debate. Steve, good to have you on the program.
Good to be here, Meghna.
So first of all, I actually want to start off with one more piece of tape from today's debate. This is Representative Sheila Harrington. She's a Republican of Groton, and let's listen to what she had to say.
5 years ago, I stood before this membership and I asked you to vote against the Transgender Equality Bill. I know now that when I spoke 5 years ago, I was wrong.
So that really caught our attention, Steve. I mean, why her change of heart? Did the governor's decision to that he said he might sign this bill if it hits his desk, did that pave the way or clear the way for representatives like Harrington?
It may have played a role in her decision. She said before the House membership today that this time she really took a close listen to the testimony that was given. She met with transgender people and has a better understanding of what they face, and that's why she is supporting the bill. The governor's move yesterday gives moderate Republicans some cover, and I would expect to see maybe a half dozen or so Republicans out of the 32-member Republican caucus ultimately vote for this bill.
Mm. So what was or has the atmosphere been like during today's debate?
Well, let me tell you, it's very charged here. I've been covering the budget debate here, and there's hardly a peep. Today, needless to say, the halls are just filled with supporters and opponents. Most of the supporters are in the House gallery watching the debate. They got here a little bit earlier and were able to get in. Some of the opponents, they're outside. They're watching some of the debate on some large-screen TVs that have been set up out in the hallway. Opponents of the bill were outside chanting "No bill, no bill" for a while. They've quieted down a little bit, but there are a lot of people here and a lot of passions in the State House.
Mm. Now, remind us what the differences are between the House version of the bill and the one that the Senate did pass. Because, of course, as we mentioned earlier, it's the current House version that Governor Baker said he would sign if it hits his desk.
There's not a lot of difference between these two bills. The House bill is tacked on just a couple of extra sentences that specifically says that the Attorney General and the Mass Commission Against Discrimination, MCAD, are required to set up some regulations and to make sure that nobody abuses this law, if it goes on the books, to do some nefarious things. So that's specifically the language in the House bill that the Senate, when they were dealing with it, said, we really don't think that this should be in there because these laws already exist. The AG already enforces the laws, and these laws are already on the books. So the Senate has said that there's no need for this language in here. However, Senate President Stan Rosenberg had said a couple of weeks ago that he sees this language as being harmless, kind of opening the door that if this language is in there, he has no problem with it.
Interesting. Well, we've got some tape here from Representative John Fernandez again, along the lines of what you just said. He took a moment to remind the House of existing language already in Massachusetts law. Here he is.
Gender identity cannot be asserted for an improper purpose. We didn't put that in now. That's been in all along. So to those who raise the fears that somebody's going to wake up one morning, 18-year-old, he's going to get out of the school and he's going to say, I want to use the locker room, women's locker room, and you can't stop me. Not true. Not true.
Well, Steve, but nevertheless, there were still a representative speaking in opposition to the bill today in the House. What were their primary arguments?
Well, there's basically two major arguments. One, which you heard Representative Fernandez rebutting, and that's that people are going to use this law for nefarious reasons, that a man can dress himself up as a woman and go into a woman's locker room and peep or abuse or do things like that. And the supporters of the bill say, no, that just isn't going to happen. The other thing that the opponents of the bill raise is that it's taking away the right to privacy that 99% of the people have by enacting this law, and they just don't think that's right.
Mm. Now, briefly, Steve, there are, 36 amendments to the Senate's version of the bill, and they're voting on those today in the House. Does it look like any of those amendments may pass?
I don't. There's a couple of technical amendments that will pass that the just kind of routine thing that happens up here. But any of the amendments that primarily Republicans, mostly Representative Jim Lyons, who we heard from earlier, has been filing to kind of weaken the bill and chip away at the bill, those are going down by wide margins. Some of them are only gathering maybe 20 or 30 affirmative votes. So they've gone through about 10 or 12 amendments so far. They got 36 altogether. So that's just taking the afternoon to go through these things, and probably by sunset tonight, this bill will be finished.
Okay, and then what happens next after the House vote?
Once the House completes its version of the bill, it would go back to the Senate. The Senate can do one of two things. They can say, yeah, we'll agree to those changes that you made there in the House. We got no problem with that additional language. Yeah, we'll accept that, and then the bill will go to the governor's desk. If for some reason the Senate, and I've been trying to find out what they want to do, if the Senate wants to insist on their version, it would go to a conference committee, and they would hammer out the differences, and then it would go to the governor's desk.
Well, Steve Brown is the State House reporter for WBUR, speaking to us today from Beacon Hill. Steve, thanks as always.
Thanks, Magna.
Well, it is Wednesday, which means it's time to talk sports.
A shot to dead center. He laid into that one. Back it goes, and kiss it goodbye. There's another drive. Hooked down the left field line, deep into the corner, and that ball is out of here. That's going to be a home run. He's done it again. Mookie Betts has had an exceptional night as he hits one deep to right field. Did he do it again? Rickard back, turning around, and that's number three.
Those little dainty ticks on the radio. They were actually three home runs last night for Red Sox outfielder Mookie Betts. That's only the 27th time in franchise history that 3 home runs in a game has been accomplished. I love how statistics-oriented we can always be here.
Well, there are two things that this brings up for me, Meghna. One is statistics orientation, as you point out. And the other is what fun it is to listen to baseball highlights. You know, people complain that baseball is too slow. What? Not this.
Not
3 home runs like that.
In 28 seconds, to be exact. And by the way, Bill, you're so excited about last night's game. You jumped the gun. I didn't get a chance to introduce you. Bill, well, not like you need introduction, but that, of course, was the dulcet tones of Bill Littlefield, host of NPR's Only a Game, and he joins us here at Radio Boston on Wednesday to talk sports. Okay, so let's dive again into it.
It's very exciting. I have done some diving.
Okay.
And I think some people may be surprised to learn how often somebody has hit 3 home runs in a game. 233 times in the American League and 246 times in the National League, according to this. Now, that may have changed because some baseball has been played since those statistics were posted, I'm sure.
And that's in the totality of baseball history?
Yeah, exactly. And among the Red Sox, the Red Sox pop up a good deal. Ted Williams, of course, a couple of times, hit 3 home runs in a game. Bobby Doerr hit 3 home runs in a game. Ken Harrelson, back in 1968. Yastrzemski in 76, Jim Rice twice, 77 and 83, and Mo Vaughn in 96. And I'm pretty sure I was at that game. And I didn't see any of the home runs because I was with my younger daughter and she kept dropping her dolls down under the seats and I was down looking for them every time Mo Vaughn hit a home run. I'm pretty sure that was 96.
You reached down between the seats and suddenly there's a roar.
Mo Vaughn hit another home run.
Well, Mookie Betts, given that list that you just read to us, Mookie Betts is in some pretty great company.
Excellent company. Of course, there is a danger in some of the company he's in because another fellow who appears on the list and who, in fact, hit 3 home runs in a single game 5 times is Mark McGwire.
Oh.
And so Mookie doesn't want to be in that company.
Yeah.
And so he has to be a little careful, probably doesn't want to hit 3 home runs again, you know, in the next game.
Yeah. Well, let's hear from Mookie Betts himself about how he felt about his performance last night.
Probably the best night, you know, it's the first time I've ever done that. You know, I was able to make a play behind probably Ross too, so, you know, for putting the whole game together, I think today was the best day.
He's referencing that diving catch that he made in the last night's game as well. So overall, Bill, how do you like the Sox?
Well, what's not to like? They got a guy who hits 3 home runs in a game. They're playing very well, and of course they're benefiting from the fact that this streak that they're on right now is coinciding with Baltimore's bad streak. And so the Red Sox have opened up a little daylight, and there's nothing not to like. You might hope that the pitchers that they thought were going to be very good would get a little better as the weather stays warm. But aside from that, there's nothing not to like.
Yeah. Well, let's move on to basketball because we have the NBA Finals to look forward to. It's going to be Golden State versus Cleveland, and see if I can remember properly, Bill. Was it some time ago you sat right here across from me at the table and said, yeah, that's Steph Curry. He looks small.
He did.
We should have just played that tape again,
They were
actually.
Down one game to 3, and he did. He disappeared. You know, there were stretches where Steph Curry, most valuable player in the NBA, simply didn't seem to be present. And then, all of a sudden, in this magnificent comeback, winning 3 games in a row, he was huge, no longer small. Of course, if you can throw the ball in from 75 feet away, you don't have to be tall because the tall guys are all closer to the basket waiting for you to do something in there. He's been magnificent, and his teammates have been magnificent. And as far as I'm concerned, as I said, probably 3 weeks ago, this is exactly the finals matchup that I wanted, and I think that most people want, because you got LeBron James, multi-time winner of the most valuable player, and you've got the drama of his trying to bring a championship to Cleveland, and on the other side, you got Steph Curry, basically David against Goliath because of his size, but David never shot that accurately in his life, so he's a David who has a particular affinity for hitting nothing but net. It's just a fantastic drama. It's great fun. It's the sort of finals that is likely to engage even people who don't pay a whole lot of attention to the NBA and pro basketball during the regular season, which is probably a fairly large number of people. But this is great fun, and I, like lots and lots of other people, are really looking forward to this series.
I'm hoping it goes seven games, to be perfectly honest.
The beauty of seven games, and in the case of Cleveland's winning their conference championship, even six games because they lost two and suddenly looked a little vulnerable. The beauty of the longer series is that storylines develop.
Yeah.
And you brought it up yourself, you know. Oh, my goodness, Steph Curry suddenly looks small. What happened to him? And everybody's saying, what's the matter with this Steph Curry? He can't play defense. And then he says, well, yeah, but watch what I do tonight. And you've got your storylines developing, and suddenly the thing becomes great fun, way, way beyond the obvious attraction of brilliant athletes playing brilliantly while everybody's paying attention, which is, you know, part of the reason, right, obviously, that we pay attention to sports at all.
Great drama on the court. Hey, Bill, in the last couple seconds that we have, I would love a preview of what's coming up on Only a Game this
weekend. Well, we're going to do something. You were talking earlier about statistics. So we're going to do something that's kind of fun, which is we're going to examine the sort of revolution in the way people are looking at baseball statistically. There's a group of people who were saying the win is not the important thing. And you know, I grew up thinking a 20-game winner, that's the definition of an excellent pitcher. He wins 20 games a season. Now these analytics guys are saying, no, that's too arbitrary. You only ought to be looking at walks, strikeouts, ERA, other sorts of statistics, because the win, you know, if the guy leaves the game after pitching, allowing two hits and no walks in seven innings, and then his relief pitchers blow the lead, the guy who started the game and pitched so brilliantly gets nothing.
Yeah.
Gets no win. Well, he's still got a great ERA. He's still got a lot of strikeouts. So that those statistics measure properly the credit that he should get. So it's an interesting debate, and we're going to go all the way back into the late 1800s to find out sort of how these statistics developed, measuring baseball players and pitchers particularly.
Oh, interesting. Well, here's another statistic. If your clock on Saturday gets stuck at 7, it will be right exactly twice, and those will be the same times that you'll hear Only a Game on WBUR at 7 a.m. and 7 p.m. Bill Littlefield, host of NPR's Only a Game, always great to have you.
Great to be here. Thank you, Meghna.
I'm Meghna Chakrabarty. We'll be right back. This is Radio Boston. Welcome back to Radio Boston. I'm Meghna Chakrabarty. Here's a fact about American politics. At one point in time or another, just about every politician seeking higher office, specifically the highest office in the land, claims to be an outsider. This year's really no different. For example, here's Donald Trump calling into CNN's Chris Cuomo last year.
They know that I'm a smart guy who gets things done, and I want things done properly. And I don't want them done for myself. I made a lot of money. I don't want money. I don't want people giving me money. I want to do something great, and great is to make our country great again. I'm not a politician. Politicians are all talk and no action, Chris, and I'm the opposite.
And earlier this year, MSNBC's Casey Hunt spoke with Bernie Sanders, and she asked him about the anti-establishment strain in American politics.
There's a lot of anti-establishment fervor on both sides of the ideological spectrum. What do you think is driving that?
Media has missed the secret. The middle class of this country is disappearing. I know that's not something on TV every night. That's the reality.
And at a Democratic debate in February, Hillary Clinton took issue with the fact that her opponent, Senator Sanders, frequently characterizes her as an establishment candidate.
Senator Sanders is the only person who I think would characterize me, a woman running to be the first woman president, as exemplifying the establishment. And I've got to tell you that it's really quite amusing.
Well, Princeton historian Sean Wilentz says that outsiders almost never make lasting political change in this country. That hard, messy work is done by politicians and political parties. And in fact, partisanship is essential to the well-being of American democracy. And he writes about this in his new book. It's called The Politicians and the Egalitarians, The Hidden History of American Politics. And Sean Wilentz joins us now in the studio. Professor Wilentz, welcome to Radio Boston.
Great to be here, Meghna.
And I should say that you'll be at Harvard Bookstore speaking about your new book tonight. We have information about that at radioboston.org. But first, I mean, just take us back as far as necessary. I mean, at what point in time, or when did this first sort of sense of unease between individual politicians and American political parties make itself known?
Well, that tension goes back to the beginnings of American politics. But the question, I think, is not so much about insiders and outsiders, which we'll get to, but at the beginning, it's the question of political parties at all. Mm-hmm. The framers of the Constitution designed a system where they thought parties would be irrelevant, or rather that they could keep parties from actually arising. They thought that parties were divisive. They thought that parties destroyed the commonwealth. They were looking for a government in which enlightened men of property and standing would figure out what was right and get it done, and there would be something approaching concord. Even from the beginning, the United States proved to be too diverse, too conflictual a society for parties not to exist. Huh. And so very early on, rallying around Thomas Jefferson over issues like banking and foreign policy, an opposition arose. And that opposition eventually became the Democratic-Republican Party. And it actually seized power in 1800 and held it thereafter, displacing what had been the administration party, the Federalists. Now, from then on in, there's been a continual fear of parties, nevertheless.
Yeah.
Lots of people don't like parties. They think that they're degrading. They think that they are divisive. They think, for all the same reasons, they never accomplish anything. They never get anything done. It's the parties that are the major focus for our politics. And I believe that they will remain so. And let me just, it's not so much that the outsiders don't have an impact. They have a big impact in American history. That's why the title of the book is The Politicians and the Egalitarians.
Okay.
And the "and" is really important because it's really the convergence of outsiders and those inside of politics. When they converge, extraordinary things can happen.
So give us another example or two of moments like that in American history.
Sure. Well, going back to the moment I just talked about in 1800, in the 1790s, independent groups were starting. There was one here in Boston. There was New York, Philadelphia, far south is Georgia, calling themselves Democratic Republican Societies. And they were self-organized groups. They were the first really to manifest public opinion. They said, we have the right to do this. The people in power thought, the people only exist on election day, and that's when they get to vote. But after that, they should shut up and let us govern. Well, the Democratic Republican Societies thought that was not the way that America was supposed to be. The convergence came when that opposition that I talked about that rallied behind Thomas Jefferson hooked up with the Democratic Republican Societies.
Yeah.
And that's what made possible, really, Jefferson's election in 1800. The societies themselves had been suppressed, in effect, but their organization kind of continued. They remained important. So it was the convergence of the two.
Mm-hmm.
You see it in the Civil War with Lincoln and the abolitionists, certainly. You see it in the 1930s on to the New Deal, where on the one hand you have political leaders like FDR, but even more reformers like Senator Robert Wagner from New York, Francis Perkins, who's on the cabinet. They are already talking about labor reform, labor representation. They converge with the rising labor movement of the 1930s and get a lot done. The classic example that I think some of your listeners will remember, people with gray hair like me will remember, is the 1960s.
I was going to ask you about LBJ.
If you look at all there's a wonderful HBO film of the play All the Way Out, and you can see that almost that illustrates or almost celebrates the convergence better than I can ever write about in the book.
Yeah. So it's really interesting because, I mean, the examples that you bring up are truly these these moments in American history where transformation occurs at that points of convergence.
Right.
But I still keep thinking about how Americans, maybe at least how we practice electoral politics, have never fully let go of that distrust of parties. We see it all the time. This election season may epitomize that more than anything. So, I mean, how does what you write about in the book about politicians and egalitarianism and egalitarians, how does it explain the election season we've been experiencing so far?
Yeah. Well, I mean, I think what we're going through now is a somewhat abnormal period. Some political scientists have called it hyperpartisanship, particularly inside the Republican Party. I mean, the Republican Party, for reasons that I mentioned in the book, don't go into great detail about, but mentioned in the book, went through a period of rapid radicalization, really. It began with Reagan, but it actually was in the aftermath of Reagan. It really began in 1994 with the Gingrich ascendancy. And basically, the Republican Party lost its moderate wing. And once you lose that wing, there's no break on the moving further and further to the right. So now we have a situation, and the Democratic Party had its own distempers and difficulties, and you can see that in the campaign today between its, I don't want to call it establishment, but between its center-left wing and the left. And that has never, that's always been a problem inside the Democratic Party, or rather tension inside the Democratic Party. Now, they are working themselves out, the Democrats, and I think in the end they're finally going to be united. I think that in the case of the Republican Party, the radicalization of the party was so great that the base eventually looked at the quote-unquote establishment and said, you haven't done what we want you to do. You haven't delivered on the social issues. And look, after 2008, we're hurting and you haven't done anything for us. So they were ripe for takeover. Mm-hmm. And that's what Trump achieved. The real question is, in these battles, anti-partisanship doesn't really work. I mean, you can have Donald Trump come in, but he's going to do it by taking over the Republican Party. If he transforms the Republican Party, he will have, he will change it. It won't be the Republican Party of Ronald Reagan anymore. Mm. Bernie Sanders chose to run for the Democratic nomination. He was not a Democrat. He was a Democratic Socialist. But he chose to do that. So it's inside the party system. In the end, I think we're not going to see one party or the other is going to win. That's going to be the resolution of this gridlock. It's not going to be continued. Eventually, one party or the other is going to win. If you look at this election, for example, if the Republican nominee, no matter who it was, it's going to be Trump, no matter who it was. It could have been John Kasich. It could have been Ted Cruz, no matter what. If that happened, the Republicans would control every level of government, from the state houses, governorship, all three branches of the federal government, because with the death of Justice Scalia, it's pretty clear that the court will move even further to the right if a Republican wins the White House.
Right.
That's total control. It's extraordinary. Suppose a Democrat, no matter who it was to win the White House. Well, if the Democrat won the White House, there's a good possibility that the Democrats would win the Senate as well, given the numbers this year. And then the Supreme Court would be very, very liberal. Probably the most liberal Supreme Court we've seen in 30 to 40 years. Those are two dramatically different outcomes.
Yeah.
That's where this is why this is a crossroads election. It's quite apart from all the craziness. So parties matter, and parties are organizing all of that, and one party's going to win.
Right. I mean, in the last minute that we have, though, I mean, some people might say that the two potential outcomes that you laid out are exactly the reason why our reliance on party politics is not good for the United States.
Well, I mean, look, in the past, we're not going to go to war as we did in 1861. But, in the past, one party does have an ascendancy. In 1800, it was Jefferson. In 1860, the Republicans. The New Deal lasted for a long, long time. Many Republicans didn't like that, but that's the way it works in American politics.
Well, Sean Wilentz, his new book is The Politicians and the Egalitarians, The Hidden History of American Politics. We just sort of cracked open the book in this conversation today. If you'd like to hear Professor Wilentz speak more about it, he'll be tonight at the Harvard Bookstore in Cambridge. We have more information about that at radioboston.org. Sean Wilentz, thank you so much for coming
in
today.
Thank you so much for having me, Meghna.
We'll be right back. I'm Meghna Chakrabarty. This is Radio Boston. Welcome back to Radio Boston. I'm Meghna Chakrabarty. One of the great many joys of this job is the fact that we get to have a great many local folks in who are global thought leaders in their respective fields. Rodney Brooks is one of those thought leaders in the world of robotics. He's the former director of MIT's Computer Science and Artificial Intelligence Laboratory. He's also co-founder of two companies, iRobot, maker of the Roomba, and now Rethink Robotics. He spent his entire life thinking about robots and artificial intelligence. And now, from self-driving cars to Siri to those algorithms throwing out suggestions to you on Netflix and Pandora, sophisticated machines are fast becoming parts of our everyday lives. So we thought it a good time to ask Rodney Brooks where he thinks robotic technology is headed. And as with all things, where we're going has a lot to do with where we began, or in this case, where Rodney Brooks began as a small boy in 1950s Australia.
My mother bought two American books, How and Why Wonder Books. One was about electricity, and one was about giant brains, which described computers back in 1961. And the electricity book showed how to make little circuits with light bulbs out of flashlights and batteries and making switches out of strips of metal, which I cut from canned goods. And so I started building circuits, and then I tried to make my own giant brains, my own computers, when I was about 7 or 8, building little things that I called computers, and they could play games and beat people. It was best if they could beat the adults.
So you were making circuits out of tin cans?
Tin cans and nails and wires and flashlight bulbs.
Oh, wow. Okay, so it's the power of books, I guess.
Yeah.
What was it about circuits and about then later robotics and the potential of robotics that so captured your imagination?
Well, somehow, you know, I came out weird.
Thankfully, right?
I came from a family that no one had come close to finishing high school. They didn't know anyone who had a university degree. And by age 4, everyone called me the professor because I could do things with numbers and arithmetic that could beat all the adults. So I was fascinated by numbers and the patterns with them. And then the circuits were sort of putting those patterns into something physical and being able to do more with them and than just play with them in my head and on pieces of paper.
Yeah. Okay. So clearly there was more going on in your internal circuitry than for most of us at a young age.
Yeah, and I have no explanation for that. I say I won a genetic lottery somehow.
And was it at this time? How old were you when you created Norman?
All through my childhood, I tried to build computers. And I wanted to build robots, but I wasn't good at building mechanical stuff. Finally, when I was about 16 or 17, I built a robot I called Norman, based actually on a robot that I'd seen described in a book by a neuroscientist, Gray Walter, who was an American working in Bristol, England. And he had written a couple of articles in Scientific American in 1949 and 1950 describing some robots he had built, and I tried to emulate those in the early 70s, mm-hmm. very early 70s. Mm.
And I understand that, like so many people who are drawn to robotics, that you had is revelation too much of a too powerful of a phrase to use when you saw a 2001?
2001 was, the movie was incredibly inspiring to me because I was sort of working by myself, and then to see this vision of this intelligent machine in the future and what it might be, you know, it was a murdering psychopath, but apart from that, it was just exciting. And by the way, that movie essentially invented computer graphics. There were no computer graphics back then. There was no way to generate graphics at the time. It was all done with stop action and projecting with the projectors onto the back of those sheets of glass and then reshooting it. So there was a lot of invention went on in that movie, and it was really a vision of the future, which was fantastic.
Well, so then you went to college in Australia, but you ended up going to Stanford to do your PhD, right?
Correct. And I landed in Silicon Valley before it was really known as Silicon Valley in 1977. Mm-hmm. And things were just starting to heat up then, so it was a great time to be there. And if I'd tried to come a few years later, I wouldn't have got accepted into the computer science department at Stanford. I was like, it was still so small, they'd take people who would apply, and so I was lucky to get there then.
When you were in grad school, could you foresee, based on the research that was going on then, where we would be today?
I thought we'd be further along in some ways, and I didn't imagine lots of other things. At that time, I knew of three mobile robots in the world that were, you know, professional mobile robots that people actually had. I then went on here in Boston to co-found iRobot,
right.
And iRobot has sold over 16 million mobile robots. I couldn't imagine that number back then. I couldn't imagine having 16 million mobile robots. That was unimaginable. But I probably thought they would be smarter than they are today.
Uh-huh. Okay. And so why aren't they as smart as you thought they would be?
It turns out artificial intelligence is really, really hard, and we hardly understand anything, despite what some people say in the press. It's really hard. We know almost nothing. Almost nothing.
So this is really interesting, because it seems as if the popular imagination, the popular consciousness, we think that artificial intelligence is very far along, and that, you know, actually, in the last year or two, there's been all this coverage about, you know, robots are going to take your job and this, that, and the other. Even white collar workers, look out. I hear you saying that that's wrong.
Well, I don't blame the media for this. I actually think there's a bunch of,
if we need to accept the blame, we shall. I'll let you know.
I think there's a bunch of scientists and engineers who are not in AI who've misinterpreted AI, and I think people in general misinterpret AI. And let me, if I may, explain.
Please, yeah.
what I think the fundamental mistake people make. When a person does some performance of some sort, we've got a pretty good model of how that performance generalizes to other things. When a computer does the performance, it may not generalize in the same way. So, go back to the 90s. We had Deep Blue beat the world chess champion, Kasparov.
Mm-hmm.
And now you can get any number of different programs for a laptop or even your phone which have a higher chess rating than any person in the world in history. But a chess grandmaster is pretty good at teaching someone how to play chess better and coaching them. All these programs can do is say best move, not best move. They don't understand in the same way a person understands. A grandmaster, if someone's a grandmaster, you'd expect them to be able to play tic-tac-toe. Those chess-playing programs can't play tic-tac-toe. They can't play any other game. They don't even know they're playing a game. So they've got this very, very narrow performance. 2 years ago, there was a deep learning came about. And deep learning is a technique in AI. It's been around for about 30 years, but it finally got good enough. Amazon Echo, it understands your speech much better than they used to. That's because of deep learning. And there was a story in the New York Times showing deep learning labeling images and saying what's in an image. So there in the New York Times was a picture that had been labeled as people playing Frisbee in a park. And indeed, you look at it, people are playing Frisbee in a park. It did well. But if a person had written in Japanese the equivalent of people playing Frisbee in a park, you'd expect some other Japanese speaker to be able to ask them a bunch of questions that they could answer, like, how many people are in the park? Where are the people in the image? What are they looking at? Where's the Frisbee in the image? What's a Frisbee? The person who could answer in Japanese would be able to answer all those questions. All the image labeling program can do is say, people playing Frisbee in a park. It knows nothing else. You can't go any deeper with it.
Okay. So what's the barrier then to that depth of knowledge? Is it just a matter of time and complexity and computing power? Or is it, because I heard you say earlier that these programs don't even know what they're doing. Is it a question of consciousness?
These programs are not sentient in any way like
yet.
A person. but they have no intent. They have no intent. And no one I know of in the world is working on sentience or a program having intent. You know, I worked on that a little bit 20-some years ago. Didn't go anywhere. So what's happening right now and what's being driven by large companies, the AI that's being built is good at transactional mm-hmm. sorts of things. Here's an image. What's in it? So some very specialized jobs, medical jobs like radiographers, will be displaced by these algorithms. But the doctor who talks to the person and examines them and takes their history and deeply understands them and understands, oh, this person is motivated by some psychological thing and is miseating for this reason. That sort of stuff is not going to be taken away. Mm-hmm. So it's the deeper understanding of how things fit together is not being tackled at all by the AI systems at the moment.
So then tell me about the creation of iRobot.
Started out as a space exploration company. Mm. We were going to send robots to the moon and to Mars. That was our plan.
But you're best known for sending robots to vacuum people's carpets.
Eventually, we did.
I don't say that facetiously in the pejorative. It's one product which showed that sort of the possibility of robotics at a consumer level in a way that nothing else had, which is very important in terms of how we view robotics as part of our lives. But anyway, go ahead.
We founded iRobot, and for many years we didn't have a real business model. We had lots and lots of different things. Colin has a list of 14 failed business models. We worked with various governments for government funding. We worked with the Japanese government to do nuclear power plant inspection robots for a while. We were a little early on some things and a little naive on other things, and eventually in 2002 we got two business models that worked all at once, the Roomba, mm-hmm. the vacuum cleaning robot, and the PackBot, which is a robot to, under remote operation, go into bad areas and look around. They were the robots that went into Fukushima, but originally they were used in Afghanistan to look into the caves, and then in Iraq to go and poke the roadside bombs and save the soldiers from having to go out and deal with them, have the robots get rid of them.
So actually, that makes me wonder, do you think that in terms of robotics that we might come into more frequent contact with in our daily lives, that is it going to be through the military applications before we see the robots that, you know, science fiction currently presents in movies?
Well, I think right now what we're seeing is the robotification of cars,
right,
with driver assist features.
Right.
I'm not as optimistic as some people that we're going to have fully self-driving cars everywhere anytime real soon, but other things in our lives will become robotic. You know, there won't be the science fiction robot, the Rosie of the Jetsons, but there will be robotic capabilities.
So actually, I should probably just ask you a very basic question, that when we say today robot or robotics, what do you think that means?
Well, I've tried to come up with a definition of robot that I use. A robot to me is something which senses the world around it, does some sort of computation, and then takes some action outside of its own body, changes the world outside of its own body. And I say outside of its own body because I don't want a dishwasher to be a robot. Mm. That seems too trite. But a Roomba picks up dirt. A Tesla moves people around.
And so in that sense, I mean, ultimately, there should be no limit to, as time goes by and technology develops, there should be no limit to what, under that definition, a robotic device could do, right?
In principle, I see no limit. You know, I think modern science says that we are mechanisms. We are built out of molecules and chemistry, and they obey laws that we've partially identified, and we arise out of that. So in principle, one might be able to build a machine out of other material. There is a question whether we're smart enough to build such a machine. Professor Patrick Winston at MIT, for many years I co-taught the artificial intelligence course with him. He still teaches it. And he used to always start by saying that when he was growing up in Illinois, he had a pet raccoon which could get out of any cage. It was able to manipulate stuff and get out of the cage. And he said, but I never thought that it was smart enough to build a copy of itself. So I've had this view of, you know, aliens sitting up in space watching us and saying, oh, look at those little MIT professors. They think they're going to build copies of themselves. Aren't they silly? They're too stupid to do that. So we don't know how smart we are. We think we're really smart, but we may not be smart enough.
The building a copy of ourselves possibility. I mean, should that be a goal for us?
I don't think myself that's a goal. Some people treat it as a goal. But it's so far in the future, in my view. It's not around the corner, as some people think. Some people get all worked up about it and say, we've got to worry about these super intelligent robots. But they're not even close to being even badly intelligent yet, you know, poorly intelligent.
Well, these some people that you're talking about, though, are, at least as far as we've read, Elon Musk, because we were talking about Teslas before, Stephen Hawking, Bill Gates. I mean, they've specifically...
Bill pulled back a little bit.
True, and they also had a specific warning about weaponized robots and hyper-artificial intelligence with that.
Well, it was hyper-artificial... But some of their colleagues have talked about robots being too literal, and you say... Tell the robot to make a lot of paper clips, and it just takes all the metal in the world and makes paper clips. You're not going to build a system like that. Because before a robot was super intelligent and did bad things, there'd be ones that weren't quite so intelligent and did stupid things. And before that, there'd be stupid robots which did bad things. So it's a process.
I take your point about the evolution of the technology, and I definitely take that to heart because it's true. I mean, it's not. We don't see the technological equivalent of punctuated equilibrium, I suppose. But with the smartphone example, though, it does bring up the other side of the coin to that, which is, you know, it was just a couple years ago where the first smartphone was introduced, and it has had a high-speed, powerful impact on the way everyone lives. And I suppose that's the kind of thing that people, when it comes to robotics, are similarly... Not everyone's concerned, but they wonder about that when that change point happens, what will it mean for us?
I think the smartphone is a great example because the smartphone was built on top of a whole bunch of other technology, which has been quite astounding. So it didn't come all at once. But another thing that it shows is it's been said that people overestimate technology in the short term and underestimate it in the long term. Uh-huh. So this thing about robots being super intelligent and being nasty is overestimating the short term.
Well, on that point, I think it was Stephen Hawking who wrote that in the short term, the impact of artificial intelligence depends on who controls it, but in his mind, in the long term, it depends on whether it can be controlled at all. I mean, again, that's a nightmare scenario.
Yeah, but I think that's a little like worrying about overpopulation of Mars. We don't know what it's going to look like. And by the way, Stephen Hawking and Elon Musk and Max Tegmark, the physicist, and Nick Bostrom and other people, none of them work in AI. None of them understand AI. It's like me being worried about black holes. You know, Stephen Hawking is studying black holes. And, you know, I know from Heisenberg that when you look at one of those things, you change it. So maybe you shouldn't be studying it because the black holes will come and eat us all. That's stupid. But that's sort of, I think, the level of their argument.
Yeah. So let's talk about the present-day state of the technology. I mean, what do you think are some of the more or most compelling potential uses for robotics in the next 5 years?
Well, I think what's going to drive robotics over the next 30 years is the demographic inversion in the world, the aging population. Uh-huh. But here's an example. In southern Denmark, around Odense, there are people who go to government workers who go to people's homes and clean the homes. But they require that the person have a robot vacuum cleaner so that the government worker is able to be much more efficient cleaning the older people's homes for them than doing it all by hand. So there's an example of a robot being pulled into elder care. Not directly. It's not being a companion to the person, but it's letting them have clean homes through some assistance program.
So you've spent a good part of your career here in Massachusetts, and I'm just wondering what your take is on the state of your corner of the tech industry in Massachusetts right now.
Well, I think Massachusetts is the place for robotic startups. You know, you see Amazon, for instance, bought Kiva Systems, and now it's become Amazon Robotics, and it's got multiple sites, and they're hiring like crazy. You know, maybe the venture capital community here wasn't, you know, didn't produce the social networking companies, but it did produce the robotics companies.
One last thing, because you know, because we've been talking about how no matter what people on average think, we haven't come all that far in artificial intelligence. But do you think that one day it will be possible to create robots that have emotion or a semblance of emotion?
We don't really understand where the separation is between inanimate and animate. Mm-hmm. And I refer to it as the juice. What is the juice of life? And, you know, it's sort of a joke to call it the juice, because I think it's just mechanistic. It's sort of like, you know, at one point we didn't know calculus, and then once we knew calculus, we could do all new sorts of things. We don't know even what the right questions are to get us there yet. So I think that in my lifetime, in your lifetime, in your children's lifetime, we're not going to see those sorts of devices. We're in Greek mathematics. We don't even understand that calculus is needed yet.
Yeah. But we'll keep asking the questions, hopefully, to get
ourselves there.
We will
ask the questions, and we'll make progress and build useful things along the way.
Well, Rodney Brooks is a professor emeritus of robotics at MIT. He's also co-founder of iRobot and co-founder of Rethink Robotics. Thank you so much for speaking with me.
Thanks for having me here.
Well, Radio Boston is produced by 100% natural intelligence. It is contained in the minds of producers Emma Jean Weinstein, Kathleen McNerney, Jamie Bologna, and Allison Bruzek. We had help today from Virginia Marshall and Adam Asher. Tim Skog is our technical director. Engineering assistance today from Jeff Turton. Our executive producer is Hitesh Hathi. I'm Meghna Chakrabarty. Join us again tomorrow for more Radio Boston.